Well, as always, it's a great pleasure to be here. And the reason of my talk is actually came from Tony. We had a dinner in January, and it turned out we were discussing some historical things, and I noticed that Tony at least had some things not about Dutch physics, which I knew were not completely correct. For example, Ehrenfest, the idea was here, I think, that he suicided because he thought his achievements were too little in physics. But we know in Holland that this was not the case. He had a mentally disabled child, and they cared for this child at home. But when he grew older, he got very worried that if he would die, this child would be institutionalized, and so he could not bear that idea. And so he killed his son and himself, basically, because of that. So, but anyhow, it's nice to know some history, but I'm certainly not a historian of science, so it's just some notes on history, in particular in astronomy, because I'm an astronomer. Between Dutch astronomy and American astronomy, we have had very long ties going back about 100 years, and I think from both sides there has been a lot of influence, and I would like to tell you a little bit of that, about that today, and also about the connection with physics, because that was also very strong. Actually, we have had what we call in our country two golden ages of physics and astronomy. The first one was in the 17th century, late 16th and in the 17th century, and the second one started in the last quarter of the 19th century with the reform of the Dutch university system. I will talk most about that last part, but I would like to start with our first golden age. Actually, you may know that the Flemish had very good map makers already in the 16th century. The map making Mercator, his real name was just Kramer, and Kramer is a peddler. But when you Latinize a peddler, it becomes Mercator, and it sounds much better. So Mercator founded this famous school of map making, and then we had this clash with the Spanish, the Protestant people. They wanted to burn the Protestants at the stake, so the Dutch made themselves free of the Spanish Inquisition and of the Spanish, but the Flemish were not free, but many of those fled to our country, and particularly these mapmakers came also to the Netherlands, and one of them was a Calvinist minister with the name Plancius, also a Latinized name, it just means flat foot, but Plancius sounds much better, and he was intrigued by the southern sky. Already for 100 years, the Spanish and the Portuguese had been, and also the British, had been going to the southern hemisphere, but they never charted the stars there. And he wanted to have a real good map of the southern sky. And so he was very frustrated that he couldn't get the right data. For example, he learned from the Portuguese that the Magellanic clouds were on both sides, so the southern pole was in the middle of the two Magellanic clouds, and we know nowadays this is not the case, so the measurements by the Portuguese and Spanish were not very good. And so he decided in 1595 to start an expedition to the Indies, also for making money on spices, of course, but he wanted the sailors and the captain to measure very accurately the southern sky, the stars on the southern sky. And Frederick de Houtman and Dirk Jansson Keizer were the guys, the captains who he instructed of those two ships, and they went to the Indies and came back 2 years later. They stopped their ship near Madagascar for about a month to measure all very precisely the positions of the stars. And he had instructed them actually already before going there. All the sailors were well instructed to do these measurements. There were no telescopes at that time, so you had to do it just out of your hand. And they came back and had the positions of the 136 brightest stars around the southern pole. And then Plancius put them in 12 new constellations, and the first map globe of the southern of these new constellations was published in Amsterdam then by another Flemish guy called Hondius. Hondius just means the dog. Hond is a dog. But Hondius sounds a lot better. So Hondius published this first globe of the southern, these 12 new constellations, which were just invented by Plancius. He gave them maritime names like Vela, Octans. Octans is an instrument to measure the distances between stars, Triangulum Australis, and also some animals like tropical animals like a camel and a chameleon and a peacock and so. And those are still there. The next year, one of these guys, Keizer died on the way back to the Netherlands, so he never made it back to the Netherlands, but he had done most of the measurements. But Frederik de Houtman went back together with his brother. They both were captains. They got into a war with the Sultan of Aceh, and Cornelis was killed, and Frederik was captured, and he was 3 years in captivity in Aceh, and during that time he measured another 160 stars. Apparently he had a lot of time. And so when he came back, he had the positions of 300 stars, and those were later published by Kepler in his Tabulae Rudolphi, and for 100 years those were the best positions and magnitudes of the southern sky. Then Halley did a better job. He went to St. Helena, telescopes were invented, and so 100 years later Halley made a much better map. Now the telescope was invented just by accident by some guy also in Holland, in Middelburg in 1608, Lippershey. They put just two lenses in a tube, and they had probably the lenses in their hands and realized, hey, it looks like the tower is just closer to us. So then they made a telescope. Galilei heard about that. The telescope was very popular. The same year already you could buy it on markets in Köln and other places, and Galilei heard about it, and you know of course that he looked at the stars with this telescope. We know that Galilei had a Dutch telescope, because the special thing about the Dutch telescope is that the eyepiece is a negative lens and the objective is a positive lens, and Galilei's telescope had all a negative eyepiece and a positive. Kepler invented the one with the positive eyepiece a little later, but we know that Galilei just used this Dutch accidental design, actually, because it was just playing around with lenses. This guy discovered that. Now, the greatest physicist and astronomer we had in this first golden age was, of course, Huygens, Christian Huygens. He was the son of one of the highest persons in our government. The Secretary of State was Constantijn Huygens, his father. And he also had a brother called Constantijn. And both his father and his brother were writers and poets. And for some reason or another, writers and poets always get much more famous than physicists. Unless you are Einstein, I think, most physicists are not very famous. And we don't have streets called after Christian Huygens, but we have streets called after his brother, which nobody knows in physics, I think, and hardly anybody knows anymore. And Christian Huygens was really a great physicist. His father did not believe in schools, so he educated his kids himself at home in mathematics, in physics, in languages, and also in sports, horse riding and all these things. And Christian was very interested in physics, and he ground lenses. He knew Spinoza also was a lens grinder, we were colleagues in that thing. And with one of his telescopes, he discovered then that Saturn has this ring, and also the largest moon of Saturn, Titan, was discovered by him when he was still a young man. And you know him very probably because he also invented the pendulum clock. Galilei had always the problem, how do you measure time very accurately? And Huygens, by his invention of the pendulum clock, had made an instrument with which you can measure time very accurately. And for this work on this pendulum clock, he discovered the formula for centrifugal acceleration, centripetal, the way it depends on how you want to call it. And that law was, of course, very important, because if you combine it with Kepler's third law, you can derive that gravity force decreases from the sun as 1 over r squared. And that's what Robert Hooke and Newton then did, using this formula of Huygens. The King of France wanted at a certain moment to have something like the Royal Society in England, so he wanted to have an Académie Française, and then he invited Huygens to become the first president, and so the rest of his career he made in France from 1672 on, from Louis XIV, who was our enemy, actually, from the Netherlands. We had an invasion by that guy at some point, which was very bad for our country. But anyhow, Huygens wrote also the first book on probabilities, and he wrote also a first science fiction book on life on other planets, which is quite amazing. It was an interesting character. Anyhow, this was our first golden age, but the second golden age started, as I said, in the last quarter of the 19th century, and that was due to a reform of our university system by a new law in 1876. Our government had realized that you needed the natural sciences if you really wanted to become a modern country, and so in this new law they created many new professorships in mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology, and those type of fields. And 25 years later, that led to this list of Nobel Prizes in physics, for example, because they had appointed just the right people on these new professorships. For example, Lorentz, who was entered university very young, at the age of 16, got his PhD at the age of 21, and then was appointed, because of this new law, there was a new professorship there, he was appointed at the age of 25 in 1878 as a professor of physics in Leiden. And then Amsterdam University had never had a professor of physics. They had just a docent of physics for the medical students. But the new law gave them also a professorship in physics, again also to teach mostly the medical people, of course. And they appointed van der Waals on that chair. Van der Waals had a very different career from Lorentz. Lorentz, just from high school, went to university, became professor. Van der Waals was a primary school teacher, and in his spare time, in the evenings, he studied for a certificate for secondary school teacher, and he got that. He became a principal of a secondary school, and this was a very good type of secondary school, which had been created around 1860, with a lot of physics and mathematics in there. And then he went on to Leiden University in the evenings to study for a university degree. And then he made his famous thesis, this van der Waals forces and all these type of things, in Dutch, as you probably know. And this thesis apparently got very famous, because people told me that Maxwell learned himself Dutch in order to read van der Waals' thesis. In any case, then he made it then also to university professor. He was appointed in 1877. So he was a primary school teacher, a secondary school teacher, and a university professor later, in his mid-30s. Van der Waals, of course, was very important also for this other group of experimental physicists in the Netherlands, Kamerlingh Onnes' group, who were trying to liquefy hydrogen and helium, and this law of van der Waals was very instrumental for guiding Kamerlingh Onnes' work. And you know Kamerlingh Onnes because of his discovery of superconductivity, of course. But probably what you do not know is that he did not discover superconductivity, but his student did it. That was Gilles Holst. But in those days, of course, the professor always get the credit. And Gilles was nicely acknowledged in the paper. But there were no bad feelings about such things in those days. And later, when we had this Philips light bulb company in our country, which now is Philips Electronics, and they had heard that Edison here in America had a laboratory in order to invent new things. And the Philips brothers thought, oh, that's a good idea. We also want a laboratory. So they went to Kamerling Onnes and said, do you know a good guy who could start a laboratory for us? And then Kamerling Onnes said, yes, I had a student. And the student, Gilles Holst, he recommended to the Philips brothers. And so he founded the Philips Research Laboratories, which have now thousands of academics working in there. And later, Gilles Holst was succeeded by Casimir as a director of these laboratories. And Gilles Holst was very happy with his life, I think. So far about physics. That same time that Lorentz and van der Waals were appointed because of this new law, our government also created new professorships in astronomy. We had three state universities at that time, Leiden, Utrecht, and Groningen. Now, Leiden and Utrecht had an observatory, and so they had a professor of astronomy, but the government said, we also want one in Groningen. And now, in Groningen, there was no observatory, but they appointed a man called Kaptein there. He had studied mathematics in Utrecht and went then on, after his PhD, to work as an assistant at Leiden Observatory. And so when this new chair came there, then he was appointed in Groningen. His problem was that there was no telescope there and no observatory there. He didn't even have a room in the university. He had to work at home. What? Well, in the other places there is no blue sky either in the Netherlands, so don't worry about that. It may be even better in Groningen, actually. A little better. It's a little colder. But anyhow, he was there, and he had no instrument. So he asked the government, could I get a little money to buy a telescope or have a little observatory? And then they asked the other observatories in Utrecht and Leiden, and they said, no, don't do that. So he got nothing. And they said it's already enough that there are two observatories in this country. But then, he didn't know what to do. He wanted to do research, but he had no instrument. And then he read in an English journal that there was a person in South Africa who had just the opposite problem. He had an observatory. He was making beautiful pictures of the sky, but had nobody to work on them. This was the time that photographic studies were just beginning. Before that time, everybody did everything with the naked eye. This was David Gill in South Africa. And he wrote, is there anybody who can help me measure those photographic plates which I'm taking? And then Kaptein said, yes, I could do that. And so they started a collaboration and to measure very accurately the positions of the brightest stars, 500,000 on the southern sky with arc-second accuracy. And to do that, Kaptein had to borrow a second-hand microscope from the professor of physiology in Groningen, who was his friend. This professor also loaned him two rooms in the university in his lab where he could work. And so working for 10 years with an assistant, he measured these 500,000 stars, and then they did it another time, because you want to measure proper motions. And so if you do this at two epochs, and some stars have large proper motions, you see them moved. Stars which are nearby have large proper motions, stars which are far away have smaller proper motions. And in that way, by comparing groups of stars, he could also statistically determine distances. And he discovered also something just of groups of stars, not parallaxes, but from the proper motion you get the distances. And so he discovered also what are called stellar streams. There were two opposite streams of stars in the sky. We now know that this is a kind of strange effect due to the ellipticity of stellar orbits around the galactic center, but at that time nobody knew what it was, but he was famous because he discovered these streams of stars in the sky. Kapteyn did not know about extinction, so he did not know that there is this interstellar dust which makes distant stars fainter. And because of that, his system, in his system, the sun is close or almost in the center, and in all directions the number of stars decreases. He has statistically got the distances from the proper motions, and he had that system where we are in the center. That is due to this fog between the stars. When you are in a fog, you can see only to a certain out to a certain distance, and there you cannot look further, and then it looks like you are in the center. But he didn't know that. Only in 1935 this was really discovered by Trumpler. But this model he only made much later, around 1920. Now, just an intermezzo. Here in the U.S., you had George Ellery Hale, who founded Yerkes Observatory and later Mount Wilson Observatory, built the biggest telescopes in the world. He discovered the Zeeman effect in sunspots. And so he corresponded, and in 1908 he discovered that also with Zeeman about this. He was very enthusiastic that he found that indeed on the sun you have magnetic fields. But Hale also had met Kapteyn here in the United States. In 1904 there was a, he organized a symposium in St. Louis and invited Kapteyn, who was famous because of his stellar streams which he had discovered and also his model of the galaxy. He invited him for this symposium and he got very impressed by Kapteyn and his work. And so somewhat later, when he had founded the Mount Wilson Observatory in 1908, he offered Kapteyn an appointment for 3 months per year to come to Mount Wilson and advice about what to do with all these nice big telescopes he was building there. And Kapteyn happily accepted that, so he came between 1908 and 1914, when the First World War broke out. He came 6 times for 3 months per year with his wife to Mount Wilson. Hale had built a special house for him on the mountain, which is still there. The Kapteyn cottage is still there on Mount Wilson. He met on this Mount Wilson also a student of Hale, Harlow Shapley. And Shapley was a man who was working very young, was 28 at that time, 1908, who was working on determining the distances of globular clusters using pulsating stars. These are a kind of standard candles. If you know the pulsation period, you know how bright the star is and the real brightness, and you can determine its distance. And so he was determining the distances of globular clusters, and he found a totally different picture than what Kapteyn had. He found that the globular clusters are distributed in the kind of sphere with a center in the direction of Sagittarius, but very far away from us. So his idea was the center of the galaxy must be not here, but further away. So Kapteyn and he discussed about that. It was not completely clear what the picture was, what Shapley had. He thought maybe there are several systems like Kapteyn spread around in our galaxy. So it was not completely clear that he was thinking about one disk system. But in any case, they were debating these type of things here on Mount Wilson. So this was the first connection between Kapteyn and the Dutch astronomy with the United States. And that has gone, that was the start of a collaboration of about 100 years now. Kapteyn produced a lot of good students in Groningen, having no observatory and no telescope. He was a very inspiring lecturer. And his first PhD student was De Sitter, whom you see here in this picture, who got in 1901 his PhD with Kapteyn. De Sitter came from a very upper class family in our country. They only produced judges and regional governors and those type of people. And his father was very opposed that he would go and study mathematics, because that, you didn't do that in a family like that. You studied law and things like that. But anyhow, the sitter wanted to study mathematics, and when he was in Groningen, he was so impressed by Kapteyn that he wanted to become an astronomer, and he got his PhD with Kapteyn in 1901. In 1908, at the advice of Kapteyn, he was appointed a professor in Leiden, when there came an opening there, and this is how he was connected with Ehrenfest and Lorentz. And Einstein, as a good friend of Lorentz, and also of the sitter and Ehrenfest, had accepted a special professorship in Leiden for a number of years, where he came 1 month a year to lecture in Leiden. And that started only after the First World War, but already during the First World War he knew the sitter, of course, very well, and the sitter heard from his general relativity theory and also about Einstein's idea of a universe with a lambda, with the cosmological constant. And they were discussing these type of things by postcard. I have here a postcard, but there are many which have been found in the archives of Leiden Observatory, but from Einstein to the sitter. They were written on postcards because of censorship, because it was war, and the German government did not want closed envelope. They wanted to know what you were writing to other people. And so this is why it was done on postcards. And this is an interesting postcard. The sitter had tuberculosis his whole life, so from time to time he had to go into a sanatorium, and this was written to Sanatorium Dennenort in the countryside in the Netherlands. And then he writes, Liebe de sitter, hoffentlich bekommt Ihnen die Ruhe dort recht gut, so dass Sie bald wieder in Ordnung sind, so hopefully the rest is good for you, so that you will be better again. And then he says, mir geht es erheblich besser, dank guter Pflege. It means it goes better with me also, because I'm cared for very well. He just had moved in with his niece. He had an ulcer at that time. And so these guys were complaining about their diseases. But then later in this letter, at the bottom, you see something interesting. Eines bleibt jedenfalls, das allgemeine Relativitätspostulat gestattet die Zufügung eines Gliedes lambda g mu nu in die Feldgleichungen. So here you have the lambda. And he says then it will become clear at some point from the observations of stars and of the motion of stars whether this really is something that happens in the real universe or not. So from the Lage der Spektrallinien, as function des Abstandes, kann man es dann sehen, of the universe is expanding, yes or no. And so in the end, apparently he believed that the sitter was prejudiced that the universe was already expanding, and so he said, Überzeugung ist eine gute Triebfeder, Feder, aber ein schlechter Richter. So it's a good guidance to be convinced of something, but it's not a good judge. Anyhow, but this was an interesting postcard, and there are many of them in this correspondence. And you know, of course, that the lambda was introduced by Einstein to prevent the universe from collapsing. It was a repulsive force. And Einstein had this model with mass and no motion, but then the sitter said, the density of the universe is so low, why don't I put it zero? So he had no mass, and then he had motion, it started to expand. And up to Hubble's time, people believed that the expansion, and Hubble himself believed that it was due to the sitter idea, but we now know, of course, that the Friedmann models also give expansion, and you don't need lambda. And so lambda was out for a long time, but we now know that it's back again with inflation and also with dark energy. It's coming back in through the back door. Let me see, what is the time? I should move on. Yeah. In 1918, the director of Leiden Observatory suddenly died. The sitter, being always sick, he was offered the interim directorship, but the university was not sure whether they wanted to have him because of his health as a real director. And the Minister of Science actually had a friend in Utrecht who was an astronomer, and he rather wanted to push the friend into the directorship of Leiden Observatory. And then, lucky enough, Lorenz and Kapteyn together wrote letters to the minister that that would be very bad to do because the sitter was by far the best guy to be the director. And so, thanks to this pressure of Lorenz and Kapteyn, the sitter was appointed. Shortly afterwards, he got very sick because he got an operation, and in this operation, they used too much ether for anesthetics, and his lungs were already bad, and so they were ruined even further. And then he had to go to Switzerland for 2 years to be in a sanatorium in Switzerland from 1919 to 1921. But in any case, at that time, Kapteyn had retired, and the sitter had asked him to be the deputy director in Leiden, and so the Kapteyn held out for him for a while. The sitter wanted to reorganize the observatory because it was really a bit run down, and he wanted new professors to be appointed, and he wanted, this was 1918, the war was not yet over, and so you could not take a German, Holland was neutral, and you could also not take one of the Allied people because then the Germans might get angry at you. And so basically you had to look for neutral countries, and so he spotted Hertzsprung, who was Danish, and offered him a professorship, and he came to Leiden and he became a professor there. And then the other guy he wanted to have was a person who had studied astronomy in Leiden, was a very good astronomer, Pannekoek, but also was a great Marxist. He edited even a journal together with Lenin from 1915 and 1916, and he was very famous in the communist movement, which made him not very popular with our very conservative government in the Netherlands. And actually, they did not want to appoint him in Leiden. They really bluntly told the sitter, this is impossible. Now, lucky enough, Amsterdam University is not a state university, so we had nothing to do with the minister at that time. Nowadays we are, but at that time not. And Amsterdam was left-wing at that time, and so they appointed Pannekoek, and this started my institute in Amsterdam, actually. It would not have existed if Pannekoek had not been a Marxist. So I'm very happy that he was. And he was very famous in the Marxist movement, you know. One of his books I just found on internet, you can still buy it, 2003. This is Lenin as a philosopher. You know, in the beginning he was friends with Lenin. They were both theorists in 1915, 1916. But then when Lenin started putting everything in practice, Pannekoek very much disagreed with him. He thought that this whole state, dictatorial of the state was totally wrong. And he wrote many things against Lenin. And so Lenin had him expelled in 1921 from the international communist movement. And he wrote, then one of the books he wrote was Lenin as a philosopher. Pannekoek was an outstanding astronomer. Harvard gave him a honorary degree in 1936 for his work on stellar atmospheres. And at that time, none of the professors in Amsterdam in physics could teach quantum mechanics in the 20s. But Pannekoek taught quantum mechanics already, so all the physics students always came to Pannekoek for the quantum mechanics. De Boer told me this, the founder of the Theoretical Physics Institute in Amsterdam. But Pannekoek was a very interesting character. Now back to the connection with the United States, started with by Kapteyn. I have here a picture. Yeah, it just falls off the screen for some reason or another, but this was 1923. No, I think it's not due to the projector. No, no. But it's 1923 on the picture here. This was a meeting of the American Astronomical Society. And in this picture, you see three young Dutch astronomers, and I have enlarged a little part of this. One was Luyten, who got his PhD with Hertzsprung in Leiden, 24. He got his PhD when he was 22 and went as a postdoc to Lick Observatory. And now he was at Harvard with Shapley at that time. Van de Kamp had been studied in Utrecht, became assistant in Groningen, and then went to Lick Observatory. And Oort, whom you have here, 23 years old, and he was at Yale doing his PhD work with Schlesinger. And both of them did their PhD work in the US, but they liked to have a Dutch doctorate, so with their PhD thesis they went back to the Netherlands and then got their PhD in Groningen, both of them. Now, Shapley was their hero. You know, Shapley was the man who found this globular cluster system and found that the center of that is far away in the direction of Sagittarius, what we now know as the galactic center. And Oort in 1926 discovered that the motions of the stars in our solar neighborhood, he and Lindblad in Sweden discovered that from the motions of the stars in our neighborhood, you can also find that the whole system is turning around a center in Sagittarius about 30,000 light years away. So when Oort was 26, he did that discovery, which made him very famous. And of course, it fitted very beautifully in this earlier picture of Shapley. Shapley was a very interesting character also. He was a journalist to start with and later became an astronomer. And when Pickering died at Harvard, they asked Kaptein for advice, whom should we appoint as a successor? And Kaptein, even though he did not agree with Shapley's system, said, Shapley is the best, you should take him. And so Shapley became the director at Harvard then. Many of the students of the Sitter and Oort and Hertzsprung went to the States. You see here Bart Bock was one of the students of the Sitter and Hertzsprung. This is at 1939, just before the war, the opening of McDonald Observatory here in Texas, and Piet van der Kamp had by that time become director of Swarthmore College. And there were several more. Kuiper, I will mention later, and also Jan Schild, another student of Kaptein, was the head in Columbia University of Astronomy then. So this Kaptein school overproduced astronomers, which then immigrated to the United States. And then the war came, and nobody could go out anymore. And Leiden University and Utrecht University were closed because the professors had protested against the firing of Jewish professors. So because of that, the German government closed those universities. And when a university is closed, you have no more job, so you're eligible to go and work in Germany in military factories and all these type of things. So people without a job had to move to Germany to work. So many of the men in the eligible age went underground because they didn't want to go work there. And Oort went underground, living in the countryside in a farm somewhere. But he came back from time to time to Leiden to teach in secret. Utrecht University was closed, and the astronomy professor there, who was also my professor later, Minard, was in a camp. That was not a bad concentration camp. It was a camp in which they put very prominent people, like former cabinet ministers and professors and so. They put in this camp with the idea that if the Dutch resistance would kill some German military, you would take at random a couple of these prominent guys and shoot them. And so even though it was not a bad camp to be in, the prospect that you could be shot at random was not nice, of course. And so Minard was there for 2 years. And so his students didn't know where to go, but they finally went to the secret courses in Leiden, which Oort, while he was basically an undercover, gave. And Oort had heard about radio emission from our galaxy. He had gotten in some way through Sweden a copy of Groot Reber's discovery paper that the galaxy emits radio waves, continuous radio waves, And then Orr said, well, that would be marvelous if we could have a spectral line there, because then you can measure Doppler effects and you can see where the different, because radio waves, the galaxy is transparent, the dust is transparent for radio waves, you can see the whole galaxy. And one of the Utrecht students from the Hulst who went to these undercover courses in Leiden picked this up, and he calculated that hydrogen, which is the most common element in the universe, has a line at 21 centimeter, the spin flip. When the electron spin with respect to the nuclear spin flips, the difference in energy, 1400 megahertz, corresponds to this 21 centimeter. And he made some calculations also showing that it might be possible, might be strong enough to detect from clouds of hydrogen in our galaxy. He also calculated in, he wrote a paper in the Dutch Physical Society journal. He wrote a paper also with other lines, also molecular lines, but he thought this 21 centimeter would be the best. Now, you had to wait until the war was over, of course, before you could start trying to find that line. And lucky enough, the Germans had left some very good things, although nobody appreciated that very much. These were these Würzburg radar antennas, 7.5 meter diameter. They were all the way from Norway to France along the coast, hundreds of them. But people were so angry at the Germans just after the war that most of them were immediately scrapped as old iron, which was very bad, of course, because thinking back, you could have built a fantastic interferometer with all these things. But lucky enough, our telephone company, the chair of our telephone company, saved three of them in our country, and Ort got one of them. They were basically for shooting down Allied bombers, for flak, to see the bomber and have the right direction and then shoot. But anyhow, with this guy, they discovered in 1951 the 21 centimeter line. They were not the first ones, because Ewan and Purcell at Harvard were first a few months earlier, and Kerr in Sydney were about the same time. At that time, scientists were real gentlemen. Ewan and Purcell said, we wait. They knew that the Dutch and the Australians were also working on this. They said, we wait until they have found it also, and then we publish it all together in Nature. Could you think that they do that nowadays? But in anyhow, they were real gentlemen, and Ewan and Purcell waited 2 months with their paper, such that all of them could go in the same volume of Nature. And then with this dish, also they made the first map of our galaxy. This one was later, actually, but Oort and van der Hulst made in 1953-54 the first map of where the hydrogen clouds are in the galaxy. And this is a later map, partly from Australia and partly from the Netherlands. And again, people who did well got jobs in the United States. Westerhout became director of the U.S. Naval Observatory, again strengthening the connection we had for so many years already. Now, Oort, of course, wanted more, and at some point our government was nice enough to give him the largest radio telescope in the world at that time, the Westerbork telescope. These are 14 dishes of 25 meter over a 2 mile distance, and at that time in 1970 it was the largest radio telescope in the world. And then, because we had the most powerful instrument, astronomers from the US came and worked in the Netherlands as postdocs, and also from Australia, and one Australian came as a postdoc and became later a professor in Holland. And then, yeah, of course, the United States does not like other people to have bigger telescope than they have, so then, of course, the VLA was built in New Mexico, which has twice as many dishes, and of course the dishes are better than our dishes. They're much more accurate. And then Ron Eakes became one of the first directors of the VLA, and another one, which came as an American postdoc to the Netherlands, Miller Goss, later also he finished as a professor in Holland and then became director of the VOA here in the US. So this went back and forth. Now, Oort had another dream. He was a real good organizer, apart from being a good scientist. The US always had these big telescopes, you know. He had seen Hale building the 100-inch Mount Wilson telescope, then the Palomar telescope, and he thought Europe should have, if we really want to be competitive, also have a big telescope. But all the countries together could do it, but each individual country is too small and has too little money to do it. And particularly in the 50s, when everybody was still very poor, there was just not money around to build a big telescope in individual countries. And so he got this idea we should get European countries together. And so in 1954, he began with probing with his colleagues in France and Germany and in Belgium whether we could build one observatory together. He also went to the Ford Foundation. He said, you know, we are still poor in Europe, but maybe you could help also help funding European collaboration. And Ford Foundation thought this was a great idea. They said, well, these Europeans have always been making war with each other, you know, the French and the Germans. If we could do something to get these guys to collaborate, that would be great. And so they said, if you can get four countries together who want to start an observatory, we will serve as the fifth country. Basically, Oort thought each of these countries should contribute $1 million, and then the Ford Foundation would contribute its $1 million. And that worked, and so we had France and Germany and the Netherlands and Belgium, and then the Ford Foundation also gave their million, and then later he got Denmark also, and then in 1964, the European Southern Observatory. The idea was to have a telescope in the Southern Hemisphere. The European Southern Observatory started. And it has been a great success, as you probably know. Two of the pupils of Oort, Blau and Wolter, they both made career in the US. Blau was professor in Chicago, and Wolter was chairman of the Columbia University Astronomy Department. They later became director general of ESO, Blau the second one, and Wolter the third one. And Wolter was a fantastic diplomat, and he convinced the governments in Europe to increase their contribution for ESO fivefold so that we could build a very large telescope, and the name of the telescope is a very large telescope. He also got Switzerland and Italy in, and nowadays ESO has 11 countries, and we have indeed a very large telescope on Mount Paranal in Chile for 8.2-meter telescope, comparable to the two Keck telescopes here in Hawaii. And so, Oort was very visionary and had very good ideas, on also in the organizational field. But at the same time, he kept doing astronomy, even though he had a hard job. After the Second World War, he succeeded Hertzsprung as director of the Leiden Observatory. And he, in his spare time, kept doing astronomy. And around 1950, he got this idea about the Oort cloud of comets around our solar system. He looked at the orbits of all the comets, and he traced them back beyond Jupiter, where Jupiter always disturbs the orbits very much. And he found that when you go beyond Jupiter, the orbits never were hyperbolic. And that means that the comets were connected to the solar system. They do not come from outside. And so he came with this idea that there is this enormous cloud of comets, maybe 10 to the 11, around the solar system. And from time to time, when a star passes and mixes the cloud a little bit, it's shaking the tree, you could think, and then some comets fall towards the sun, which we then see as new comets. And I think that idea now has generally been accepted. And one of the students of the Sitter and Hertzsprung, another one was Kuiper, here, who came to our country, and he also had an idea about another group of icy objects, which is nowadays called the Kuiper Belt. This idea he had in the late 40s, I think, and now with the new telescopes, the big telescopes, people find lots of those Kuiper Belt objects, and actually Pluto is also thought to be a Kuiper Belt object. Yeah, Kuiper was, like Oort, a great organizer. He went to the United States in the 30s. He was director of Yerkes Observatory, of McDonald Observatory. He started Lunar and Planetary here in Arizona, and also the Mauna Kea Observatory in Hawaii. In 1944, he discovered that Titan has an atmosphere which has about the same pressure as our atmosphere. And you know that recently the Huygens probe has gone into Titan's atmosphere to measure all kinds of things in there. So these connections between what started from Kaptein have had a lot of impact both ways on the US and both also on the astronomy back in our country. Now back, why was I here the last 3 months? I was here for the gamma ray burst meeting, and we have had a little satellite together with Italy, and I've been involved with the building of that satellite for 12 years and for the exploitation of the satellite for another 6 years. It was launched in 1996, and the cameras in the satellite, two wide field hard X-ray cameras, were instrumental. They were built by our space research organization in the Netherlands. They were instrumental in finding accurate positions of gamma ray burst and allowed the finding of the position on the sky with arc minute precision, and so that you could find optical afterglows. They were discovered in 1997 by my colleague Jan van Paradijs in Amsterdam, and then the year after, two of his graduate students discovered that gamma ray burst also are associated with stellar explosions, with supernovae. That was the program we had here the last 3 months, about the relation between gamma ray burst and supernovae. And we're very happy that our satellite at that time was able to, for the first time, and our two graduate students in Jan together were able to find this relation, and now with the SWIFT satellite and other satellites, this has all been confirmed. So it's another part of the Netherlands-US connection, I think, that I was could be here at this workshop. So we saw that for the last 100 years we have had a lot of back and forth intertwined connections between Dutch and American astronomy. It was all started by Kaptein, a man who had no telescope and no observatory, but he produced fantastic students. The Sitter, Oort was his last student, and Schild and Van Rijn and other ones. And he laid basically the basis also by intervening with Lorenz in this appointment of the Sitter as director in Leiden. He laid the basis for the whole further development in the Netherlands. You saw also that it all started, Kaptein's appointment, from this new law for reorganizing our university system. And so the basic lesson out of all of this, I think, is you must have very good organization of your universities. And we had at that time also a very good high school system. Van der Waals was one of the principals of a high school. And yeah, those two things coincided, I think, to help this flourishing of our physics and our astronomy in the country. Thank you. Thank you.
your thought is there was a gap between what and the
The Dutch were always very focused on business and trade, you know. I mean, we had the largest multinational company for two centuries, the Dutch East India Company, with 50,000 employees, mostly in Asia. And it was trade between China and India, because it was not only trade with Europe, but also inter-Asian trade. But the Dutch were always very strong on that. They earned a lot of money with that. And with this money, they were just living off the interest. So it was a bit, after a couple of centuries, the society became very dull. And the real revival, I think, this new law, something like that started around 1850 already. We were very, I mean, we had this upper class who was living just off the interest, and we had a very big lower class who had really nothing, you know, people starving, basically. And only after 1848 we had this big European revolutions, and then we had a dictatorship king. You know, after Napoleon was defeated, Europe was reorganized, and the Orange family in our country were never kings before. We were a republic. They had a special position, you know. Your great-grandfather did something very nice for us, so you have a special position. They always wanted to be kings. And then with the Vienna Congress, they took their chance. And so at the Vienna Congress, they said, okay, let the Netherlands be a kingdom. And so and this was an absolute king. And that was not good for the country. And in 1848, we had a prime minister who said, you know, he went to the son of that king, and said, you know, revolutions all over Europe. Do you want a revolution here also? The king said, no. Then sign this now. And so he basically signed that he would be a constitutional monarch and have nothing to say anymore. And after that, the country picked up this guy who had forced the king out. Started this new school system. It was very good. And then the country picked up. But there was a long period that, we had some good people in the 18th century, but mostly they were just copying, writing good books and things like that, but not doing any novel science, actually. Yeah, the teaching was, I think, in the university was still okay, but not many opportunities, because, I mean, like I said, Amsterdam University never had a physics professor. They had just some guy teaching physics for the medical people, but no professors. And in 1860, there was the high school system first, and that was a very important thing, because then you got high school kids who really got science in high school, even astronomy, because we were a seafaring country. And the idea was most of the high school kids become captains or first officers and whatever, so they have to know navigation. So in high school, astronomy was compulsory. That bred a lot of good people. Most of our Nobel laureates came from this new high school system, actually. So schools are important. What? Yeah. Some person did an analysis of where our Nobel laureates came from, and in physics I think we had altogether 12 or so, and there was only one Catholic, while half the population is Catholic. The others were either Protestant or Jewish, and all were from above the rivers, as we call it. Above the Rhine is Protestant, and below the Rhine is mostly Catholic. Now, there is a theory that says, you know, the brightest kid in a Catholic school becomes a priest. He does not become a scientist. And that might be a drain on your bright kids, you know. And, So it's very clear. I mean, this distinction is enormously clear. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, the only Catholic Nobel laureate is now very much under fire, you know. De Bie, De Bie. At the moment, there is a lot of flak shooting at his behavior when he was at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Germany. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, and I think nowadays it certainly is no longer the case. But look at the Nobel laureates. It's very clear. And also in astronomy, most of these guys which I mentioned here were basically all Calvinists. You know, the Sitters and the Orts and the all of them actually. Well, or Jewish. But
perhaps this is a sensitive question also. Was there significant German influence on that physics?
Well, Einstein, Ehrenfest. Well, Ehrenfest was Austrian, I think, from origin. I'm sure, because Well, before the Second World War, Germany was so strong in physics that, when I was a student in the 50s, our books were largely in German still. Yeah.
Questions?